This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The GOAT's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
Holy man, does it feel good to be spinning records and digging crates once again. Hey, my lovelies, this is episode 14 of Liner Note Leftovers. I am officially back to telling you minutia, weird stories, and liner notes of your favorite rock stars, rock songs, and albums. I was taking a bit of a recharge break there for a bit, but once I got back to 106.1 The GOAT, your boy hit the ground running, so it did make my sabbatical a little bit longer. But don't worry, we're back once again. We got great stories to tell, including the story of the Beatles movie that was so bad Peter Frampton was glad he got in a car crash, the stories behind a song that is either one of the sexiest of all time or literally a meme nowadays, and the crazy story of the Riverport riot, aka that riot Axl Rose caused. No, not that one. And no, not that other one. Probably not that one either. I'll tell you which one it is. We'll get into it. But let's not waste any more time. Let's drop that needle. It's time for Liner Note Leftovers. You know, a lot of rock stars have gotten honorary degrees from colleges, universities, hell, some even got doctorates like Dr. Jimmy Page, and not so much a acknowledgement of their studies, but an acknowledgement of just the work that they have put in. But some have had to put work to get their high school degree once again, and I'm talking 25 years of it. And the person, of course, I'm talking about is Billy Joel, who on June 24th, 1992, was given his high school diploma from Hicksville High School in Long Island, New York, some 25 years after he was supposed to get it. That's right, he was supposed to graduate in 1967, but the reason he didn't is because he missed one English exam, and that threw his whole GPA out the window. Now, what was he doing that he missed this exam? Well, he was playing pianos on the song Leader of the Pack, which is by the Shangri-Las. It was a huge, huge hit of the 1960s, which Billy Joel didn't actually even get paid for. And he spent the whole night being yelled at by producer Shadow Morton. So picture this, he's making no money, he's working into the middle of the night, he's gonna miss his English exam the next morning, and he's being yelled at by a dude in a cape. But he plugs it out, he oversleeps, and with no chance to redo the test, he spends the next 25 years not only becoming one of the biggest musicians in the world, but without a high school degree. But in 92, he's thinking, I wanna lead by example, I wanna be a good guy, let me go back, let me get my degree. But rather than take a standardized test from the 1960s, the school wants him to show that he's learned anything regarding English, grammar, story, prose, good command of the language, that kind of thing. So Billy Joel starts handing in lyrics, including for the song This Is The Time, which had been played at graduations, including at Hicksville High School. So the school finally says, okay, Mr. Joel, you can graduate. He joins 305 members of the class of 92, where he makes the commencement speech that I think we all expected from him.
Mom, here I am, Mom. I'm actually going to get my high school diploma only 25 years after everybody else got there. But Mom, don't worry, because now I'm going to finally pull myself out of this dead-end job I have. Career for the real future.
But also during that speech, he suggested that don't rush blindly into a job that you're gonna hate in a few years. Don't make a lot of logical, tidy, sensible plans right away. Kick back for a few weeks and give yourself a long, sweet summer of love. Jump on your motorcycle and ride all the way to San Jose. Get a tattoo, shave your head, grow your beard. Do what you wanna do. Just don't drink and ride, and remember to wear something if you meet someone out there so you're not taking something back home. Which is sound advice, especially as we got all of our local grads graduating this week. Listen to Mr. Joel, he knows what he's talking about. But don't sleep through your English exam, otherwise you could be a rock star having to go back to school and write your English exam again. You don't want that, right? Can you imagine going to prom and your own song is playing? No, wait, that would be pretty cool. I'm getting lost. Stay in school, kids.
This is the time to remember, 'cause it will not last forever.
This is the
I don't think I would be offside in saying that there are two types of reaction to the Rob Thomas and Santana song Smooth. Either it's an immediate chorus of hell yeah, this is a vibe, or you're praying for your inner ear to explode at that exact moment so you don't have to hear it. Descriptions of the song range from slick and impeccable to a dry English muffin misted with Tapatio. But all of us gotta admit, it's a weird tune to have happen. I mean, you got Matchbox 20, which is part of this like soft rock 90s thing, and Santana, who at the time had not had a hit in almost 20 years. He'd been putting out music, the critics love it, but it wasn't selling on the radio and it wasn't selling to audiences. So at 50 years old and having a mid-career crisis, he reaches out to an old manager, the legendary Clive Davis, and he says, and Clive says to him, give me half the album and trust that I'll find the material you need. The other half is gonna be whatever you want. So they start creating the album Supernatural, and they got features like Wyclef Jean, Lauryn Hill, Dave Matthews, Chad Kroeger. I know you hate it, but it's a bop. But something is missing. Meanwhile, though, the singer of Matchbox 20 is just getting off a grueling 3-year tour. He's back in the writing phase. He teams up with Itel Shure to write a song called Room 17. And basically, it's a song about hooking up with a groupie post-show. Basically, the exact opposite of who Santana was at the time. And in fact, the song was originally written for George Michael. But it gets brought to Clive Davis's attention. He hears it and it's like, okay, we could turn this into a Santana groove. Something like Black Magic Woman, Oikomava, Evil Ways. Santana, not on board though. He's like, this ain't me. And in fact, Matchbox 20, the rest of Matchbox 20, not Rob Thomas, was skeptical too, saying, is this gonna be like Ricky Martin's Livin' La Vida Loca? To which Rob Thomas replies, no, this is gonna be a real Santana tune. And they're like, okay, have fun. Now after a lot of convincing, Santana relents when everybody tells him this is gonna be a hit. Just trust Rob, trust everybody, we're all gonna do this. They hit the studio and literally play like there's no tomorrow. Santana, his band, Rob Thomas, they put it all in, and it shows, because this was Santana's biggest hit in 20 years. It went to number one on the charts. It won them at least 9 Grammys, including Record of the Year, Song of the Year, Best Pop Collaboration, Album of the Year, Best Performance by a Duo, and Best Instrumental Performance. Because it's so stuck in your head and such an earworm, it led it to become the second most purchased song of all time, period. The only one that ever beat it was Chubby Checker's The Twist. Now, granted, it has become kind of a meme in this day and age, and lyrics from Rob Thomas like Spanish Harlem Mona Lisa kind of make you do that little up your back, but you gotta admit, you listen to this song and you know it's cool. To this day, Rob Thomas says he gets people running up on the street telling him how cool the song was, including Jason Newsted of Metallica one time, and it's created a whole effect in music called the Carlos Santana effect, which is older rock stars bringing in a young artist to hype them up. Everything you know now of that, you can thank Smooth for better or for worse. Though Rob Thomas says if grocery stores could stop adding it to the playlist all the time, that'd be great. He loves playing it, sick of hearing it. But listen to this track and tell me that you're sick of hearing it. No way. Okay, honestly, show of hands here. How many of you have looked through the Guinness Book of World Records one time and thought, big deal, I could do that. I could stack more than 5 ping pong balls on my nose in under 30 seconds. If I really wanted to, I could grow my fingernails long enough to look like the world's dirtiest kielbasa roll. Furthest distance shooting milk from my eye socket, I was doing that on the playground for quarters when I was 6. But trust me, it's a lot harder than it looks, and nobody knows that better than the Flaming Lips, who on June 28th, 2012, set the record for most shows played in the most cities in a row. They had 24 hours to play 8 shows to beat Jay-Z's record set in 2006 of 7 shows. But it wasn't just that. I know it sounds easy, but here are the rules. Each concert has to take place in a different city. All of those cities had to be pre-approved by the Guinness Book of World Records to make sure they were far enough apart. Each had to be in a recognized venue, each had to sell at least 300 tickets, and the band had to play continuously for more than a period of 15 minutes. But not to be outdone, the Lips go on tour not only with themselves, and play those 15-minute shows, but they bring along Jackson Brown, Grace Potter and the Nocturnals, and jackass stuntman Chris Pontius for some reason. At 5:04 p.m., they play at Haiti Park in Memphis, Tennessee, in 35 to 40 degree temperatures. They put on a flaming hot show, no pun intended, and despite being all sweaty, they jump right back in the van and drive all the way to the Ground Zero Blues Club in Clarksdale, Mississippi, which is a few hours away. At 9:14, they get off, they set up. At 9:13, they're playing, and rather than do 15 minutes, the show is now half an hour behind schedule. So, they load up, realize they're super late, avoid a stop at the crossroads, where Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil, even though they wanted to, and end up at the Lyric in Oxford, Mississippi. And when Flaming Lips singer Wayne Coyne says they're only gonna play about 15 minutes because they're behind time, they get a few boos. So he says, screw it, let's play some of our songs and two Zeppelin covers, with the help of Grace Potter. These Zeppelin songs take so long that they don't even get to play a song off their new album called Heady Friends. So they keep on rolling all the way down to Jackson, Mississippi. It's 3:55 in the morning, where the crowd was a little bit more receptive to the 16 to 7 minute set because it was 4 in the morning. They slam through a couple of their songs, they play a couple of songs with Neon Indian, they cover David Bowie's Heroes, and then they're back on the road again. They end up at Benny's Boom Boom Room in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, where they were going to play on the roof, but then they realized that's probably not safe, so they play one down on the stage to a packed crowd of quote-unquote weirdos that had followed the Flaming Lips all the way there, and some from town who thought it was a big occurrence. Now they gotta keep going quick because they're running out of time. They play a show at the Hard Rock in Biloxi where the bus breaks down, so they gotta spend a little bit of time to fix that. They have a press conference to fill a few moments. They rip past the Varsity in Baton Rouge, Louisiana at 2:45 p.m., do a full cover of 21st Century Schizoid Man, which is at least 10 minutes of the 15-minute set, finally finishing off at the House of Blues in New Orleans at 5:19 p.m. with literally 20 minutes to spare. By 7:02 p.m., everything's all done, which means they played an extra hour and a half. Wayne Coyne says, thank you, we love you, and everybody hopefully goes home and goes to bed. Upon being asked, though, he said he thought at 5 in the morning he would be just crawling, barely able to sing and hoping to get through, but then he felt like he could do another 24 hours, though I don't think anyone would recommend it. I don't know if Vaseline on toast is a good way to deal with that kind of throat damage.
She'll make you breakfast, she'll make you toast, but she don't use butter, and she don't use cheese, she don't use jelly.
I don't think many people would say, you know, thank God I got in that car accident and broke my wrist and a few of my ribs, but Peter Frampton might have been somebody who did. He calls it somewhat of a blessing that he was in an accident on June 29th, 1978 in the Bahamas that delayed his travel back to England, and he couldn't be there for the premiere of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which was a movie based on the Beatles album of the same name. And by all accounts, this really should have worked. I mean, you had a cast that was Peter Frampton, the Bee Gees, Aerosmith, Steve Martin, Alice Cooper, Earth, Wind & Fire, Billy Preston. The guy producing it was Robert Stigwood, who did for Disco through Saturday Night Fever what he thought he was going to do for the Beatles through Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the movie. But when I say this thing is a convoluted mess, it is a convoluted mess. Let me try and run the Coles notes by you here and see if you get what's going on. So it's all set around a town called Heartland, which is a wholesome little town run by Mayor Mr. Kite, who's played by George Burns. Every year, they have a festival to commemorate Sgt. Pepper, who died in the middle of a performance, but his grandson, Billy Shears, decides to form a new band. Everybody loves that new band. They get brought to Hollywood. They get all in on the sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing. Billy forgets about his home and his girlfriend and all that. But meanwhile, there's a villain named Mr. Mustard, who's making a band of Orwellian rock stars called the Future Villains Band, which is played by Aerosmith. And they team up with a mind-controlling cult leader named Father Son, who's played by Alice Cooper, the deranged anti-aging specialist Dr. Maxwell, played by Steve Martin, and they steal these instruments to control the world, which they will do at a benefit concert to save the town, which is deteriorated because they no longer have the instruments. Now, Aerosmith hits the stage as the Future Villains Band, and they take control of everyone's mind. They poison their brains, pollute the environment, and subvert the democratic process while playing Come Together by the Beatles, and that's where the Aerosmith version originally came from. This band steals Billy Shears' girlfriend. Billy Shears fights them on stage. They all fall off. The girlfriend dies for some reason. And perhaps one of the most painfully awkward and somewhat hilarious death scenes in a movie ever. But so does the villains band. And Billy's so sad that he considers jumping off a roof, but a weather vane that was built in the likeness of Sgt. Pepper uses laser beams to catch Billy. They play music and the whole town turns into its place of love and happiness once again. And the girlfriend's brought back to life and everybody assembles into what becomes the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's cover. And if you think that is the most confusing movie I have ever heard, most people thought that way. Because on top of that, there was no dialogue. It was all explained through the songs. It was called an evil pantomime that is just plain embarrassing. A motion picture whose awfulness can hardly be imagined on the human scale, and the equivalent of farting at a wedding. It did beat its budget, though, by about $7 million, even though it was called one of the most shocking and evil moments in rock and roll history. And George Harrison was mad, but couldn't even muster up a criticism. He said, "I feel bad. It damaged their images, their careers, and they didn't need to do it. It's like the Beatles trying to do the Stones. The Stones could do it better." So even though Universal thought that it would be this generation's Gone with the Wind, and Robin Gibb of the Bee Gees said, "When we make this movie, it will be like Sgt. Pepper's by the Beatles never existed," which I don't think that's what happened. But if you ever want to watch a movie with all your favorite rock stars that's earned a, good lord, a 12% out of 100 rating on Rotten Tomatoes, it's out there for you. But at least we got one, and I mean one, good thing out of this movie, and that's Aerosmith covering Come Together. So there's always a silver lining, I guess.
He rode a coaster, he got early warning. He got mud and water, he won Mojo Filter. He say, one and one and one is three. Got to be good looking, cause he's so hard to see. Come together right now. Oh,
you know, a lot of rock stars, justifiably or otherwise, have the reputation of being a diva. But not many are so much of a diva that they have a riot named after it. Not the case for Axl Rose, because I'm going to tell you the story now of the Riverport Riot, which happened June 2nd, 1991. And by even a court's final verdict, was all Axl Rose's fault. Now, this is of the account of Daniel Dershowitz and Christian Schaefer, who were both music journalists who were there at the time, but let's go. So, June 2nd, 91. Guns N' Roses, they're one of the biggest bands in the world, and they're playing a show at the Riverport Amphitheater, that's in St. Louis. And this was not like other Guns N' Roses concerts that ended in a riot. Yes, there were other ones, more to come. But according to Dershowitz, Guns N' Roses got through pretty much a whole set. They were firing on all cylinders. They played a lot of hits from Appetite for Destruction. They played some stuff from the upcoming Use Your Illusions Part 1 and 2. But after about 15 songs, this is 90 minutes, pretty long for a concert, they launch into Rocket Queen. And this is where things get real ugly real quick. Axl Rose is jamming and dancing around and swinging his mic as he does, but he's getting madder and madder. Why? Because this bright light keeps hitting him from the audience, and it's not a laser pointer. Turns out it's a camera, because in the pre-smartphone era, grainy photos taken by the audience could be a lucrative business. Hey, here's a picture of Guns N' Roses that you can't get out of any old magazine. Give me $50 for it. It's not like today where you throw up an awesome picture of Dave Grohl on your Instagram and you get 7 likes. That was a good picture. Somebody should pay me. Anyways, so neither here nor there, Axl Rose is getting mad, so he finally has a freak out. And because somebody was actually filming at the time, here's the freak out.
Hey, take that, now, get that guy and take that. I'll take it, goddammit. Security, I'm going home.
We're out of here.
So there are a few things there that require a little bit of extra explanation. Security refused to go down there and confiscate the camera. So Axl Rose just jumps into the crowd and he's gonna go kick the hell out of the person taking pictures. Problem: the people taking pictures was a motorcycle gang called the Saddle Tramps. And the guy with the camera was Bill Stump Stevenson, who was the MC leader. And as Iggy Pop learned before Axl Rose, if you mess with bikers, you might get your ass kicked. So at the end, he jumps back on stage, has that freak out, and you hear at the end Slash saying something. It's hard to make out, but he says, "He trashed the mic. We're going home. We're out of here." The lights come up, the exit, "Everybody be calm and leave in an orderly fashion" music starts playing, but the audience is not ready. This insult leads them to start ripping seats out, trashing equipment, throwing debris on stage. This is again according to Dershowitz here. He says some of the highlights, mental snapshots he has from that night, is a man who is naked from the waist down, running down the aisle and fighting people. Two guys playing frisbees with broken seat pieces until eventually it crashed into some guy's head where they required stitches, but they still gave out high fives for that one. And finally, everybody having to be blasted with fire hoses so that they finally leave the friggin' place. It's crazy. 65 people were injured. Hundreds of people get arrested. There's hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of property damage. In fact, the only reason Axl Rose wasn't in jail that night is because he'd already left the country. He was doing other shows. But when he got back to the States, he was charged with 4 misdemeanor counts of assault, a misdemeanor count of property damage, which he was found guilty of, and had to pay $50,000. And there were civil lawsuits. It was a whole mess. By the end of it, Axl Rose was banned from playing in St. Louis for life. But don't worry, he wasn't itching to go back, because if you look in the liner notes of Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 in the little thank you section, there's one more note that just says, "F*** you, St. Louis." So the feeling was mutual. But in 2017, the hatchet was buried. Guns N' Roses played St. Louis for the Not In This Lifetime tour, and I guess they're allowed back. The same can't be said for Montreal, though, but that's a story and a riot for another time. Seriously, 1 month and 5 days between the two, though. Crazy to think about. And with that, that's about it for this week's episode of Liner Note Leftovers. Now, hopefully you had some fun and we learned a little bit along the way. It feels great to be back in this chair. It feels great to be telling stories with you. And we're going to keep doing it every single week. Next week, we're going to have more stories, deep cuts from the history of rock and roll. As always, I love that you've come to hang out and nerd out on some music with me. Remember, always, if you got a story you want to hear on Liner Note Leftovers, you can drop me an email at olddanielmsoul@gmail.com or find 1061 The Goat on social media. I'm not big on the whole work-life balance thing, so I'll probably get to your message any time of day or night. And I'll see y'all in the next one. As I always say, grab life and your vinyl by the edges.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to MyLloydMinsterNow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.